he could have been crushed to death. Or worse, crippled and buried here where no man would ever find him, trapped until the Red Jackets came and stripped the flesh off his bones. The angry, thundering roar quieted, faded. Ramon rose from behind the boulders, waving his hand before his face as if stirring the air would somehow put more oxygen in it or lessen the thick coating of stone dust that was no doubt forming in his nose and lungs. He walked slowly forward, his footing uncertain on the newly made scree. The stones smelled curiously hot. A metal wall stood where the facade of stone had fallen away. Half a mountain high, and something between 20 and 25 meters wide. It was, of course, impossible. It had to be some bizarre natural formation. He stepped forward, and his own reflection, pale as the ghost of a ghost, moved toward him. When he reached out, his blurred twin reached out as well, pausing when he paused. He stopped the motion before hand and ghostly hand could touch, noticing the stunned and bewildered expression on the face of his reflection in the metal, one no doubt matched by the expression on his own face. Then, gingerly, he touched the wall. The metal was cool against his fingertips. The blast had not even scarred it. And though his mind rebelled at the thought, it was clearly unnatural. It was a made thing, made by somebody and hidden by somebody, behind the rock of the mountain, though he couldn't imagine by whom. It took another moment for the full implication to register. Something was buried here under the hill. Something big. Perhaps a building of some sort, a bunker. Perhaps the whole mountain was hollow. This was the big one, just the way he'd told Manuel it would be. But the find wasn't ore. It was this massive artifact. It couldn't be a human artifact. The human colony here wasn't old enough to have left ruins behind. It had to be alien. Maybe it was millions of years old. Scientists and archaeologists would go insane over this find. Perhaps even the Enya would be interested in it. If he couldn't parlay this discovery into an immense fortune, he wasn't anywhere near as smart as he thought he was. He flattened his palm against the metal, matching hands with his reflection. The cool metal vibrated under his hand. And even as he waited, a deeper vibration went through the wall. Boom, boom. Low and rhythmic, like the beating of some great hidden heart, like the heart of the mountain itself, vast and stony and old. A warning bell began to sound in the back of Ramon's mind, and he looked uneasily around him. Another man might not have reacted to this strange discovery with suspicion, but Ramon's people had been persecuted for hundreds of years, and he himself well remembered living on the grudging sufferance of the Mexicanos, never knowing when they would find some pretext to wipe out his village. Whatever this wall was, whatever reason it had for existing here in the twice-forsaken ass end of a half-known planet, it was no dead ruin. Something was at work beneath this mountain. If this was hidden, it was because someone didn't want it to be found, and might not be happy that it had been. Someone unimaginably powerful, to judge from the scale of this artifact, and probably dangerous. Suddenly, the sunlight seemed cold on his shoulders. Again, he looked nervously around him, feeling much too exposed on the bare mountain slope. Another flapjack called, away across the air, but now its cries sounded to him like the shrill and bat-like wailing of the damned. It was time to get out of here. Get back to the van, maybe take a short video recording of the wall, and then find someplace else to be. Anywhere else, even back in Diego Town, where the threats were at least knowable. He couldn't run back to his camp. The terrain was too rough. But he scrambled down the mountainside as recklessly as he dared, sliding on his buttocks down bluffs in a cloud of dust and scree when he could, jumping from rock to rock, bullying his way through bushes and tangles of scrub yerba, scattering grasshoppers and paddlefoots before him. He moved so quickly that he was more than a third of the way to his camp before the mountain opened behind him and the alien came out. High above him, a hole opened in the mountain's side, a cave in the metal that a moment ago had not been there, and now simply was. There was a high-pitched whine, like a centrifuge spinning up, and then, a breath later, something flew out of the hole. It was square-shaped and built awkwardly for flight, like something designed to move in vacuum. Bone-white and silent, it reminded Ramon of a ghost or a great floating skull. Against the great empty blue of the sky, atmosphere thin enough at the top that stars shone through the blue, it could have been any size at any distance. The strange boxy thing hung in the sky, rotating slowly, looking, Ramon thought, looking for him. Sick dread squeezed his chest. His camp. The thing was clearly searching for something, and Ramon hadn't done anything to conceal the white dome of the bubble tent or the van beside it. There had been no reason to. The thing might not see him down here in the underbrush, but it would see his camp. He had to get there, get back to the van and into the air, before the thing from the mountain discovered it. His mind was already racing ahead. Would his van outpace the flying white box? Just let him get it in the air. He could fly it low, make it hard to spot or attack. He was a good pilot. He could dodge between treetops from here to Fiddler's Jump if he had to. But he had to get there first. He fled, raw panic pushing away the last shreds of caution. The demonic white box was lost from sight as he reached the edge of the scree and dove into the underbrush. The bushes and low scrub that had seemed thin and easily navigable when he'd been walking were now an obstacle course. Branches grabbed at him, raking his face and ripping his clothes. He had the feeling that the flying thing from the mountain was right on top of him, at his back, ready to strike. His breath burned as he sprinted, legs churning, back toward the van. "I didn't see anything," he gasped. "Please, I wasn't doing anything. I don't know anything. Please, I dreamed it." When halfway back to the van, he paused, leaning against a tree to catch his breath. The sky was empty. No ghostly box hung in the air, searching for him. He was surprised to find that his pistol was already in his hand. He didn't recall drawing it. Still, now that he did think of it, the weight and solidity of it were reassuring. He wasn't defenseless. Whatever that fucking thing was, he could shoot it. He spat, anger taking the place of fear. Maybe he didn't know what he was facing, but it didn't know him either. He was Ramon Espejo. He'd tear the alien a new asshole if it messed with him. Buoyed by his bravado and rage, Ramon started again for the van, one eye to the skies. He had cleared more ground than he thought. The van was only a few more minutes away. Just let him get it in the air. He wasn't going to stop to video anything, not with that thing out there sniffing for him. But he'd bring back a force from Diego Town. The governor's private guard, maybe. The police. The army. Whatever was in the hill, he'd drag it out into the light and crack its shell. He wasn't afraid of it or anyone. He wasn't afraid of God. His litany of denial, "Please, I didn't see anything," was already forgotten. He reached the meadow that contained his camp just as the alien reappeared overhead. He hesitated, torn between dashing for the van and diving back into the brush. It was close enough that Ramon could size it now. It was smaller than he'd thought, perhaps half the size of his van. It was ropey, long white strands like the dripping of a candle making up its walls, or its face. As it swooped nearer, Ramon felt a knot in his throat. It was too close. He would never be able to reach the van before it came between them. "Perhaps it's friendly," Ramon thought. "Madre de Dios, it had better be friendly." The van exploded. A geyser of fire and smoke shot up out of the meadow with a waterfall roar, and 10 thin birds rose screaming all along the mountain flank. The shockwave buffeted Ramon, splattering him with dirt and pebbles and shredded vegetation. He staggered, fighting to maintain his balance. Pieces of fused metal thumped down around him, burning holes in the moss of the meadow floor. It was shooting at him. Through the plume of smoke, Ramon saw the thing turn, flying 5 meters above the ground, swooping toward him again. The bubble tent went up in a ball of expanding gas, pieces of torn plastic tumbling and swooping like frightened white birds in the hot turbulence of the explosion. Ramon caught only a glimpse of that. He was already in frantic motion, running, swerving, tearing through the brush. He could hear his own gasping breath, and his heart slammed against his ribs like a fist. Faster! He felt the alien craft coming up behind him more than he saw it. With a despairing cry, Ramon whirled, fired 3 times at the looming thing as fast as he could, then turned and fled again. A tree detonated as he passed it, splinters biting into his face and legs. He heard a high whine coming close, getting louder, dopplering up the frequencies. A shockwave knocked the air from him, and he lost his footing. He fired the pistol again as he fell, without knowing where he'd aimed or if he'd hit anything. Something hit him, hard. His consciousness blinked out like a suddenly snuffed candle. When he woke in darkness. Part 2. Chapter 5. In the darkness, immobile, unbreathing, Ramon found his memory growing clearer and clearer. The way Griego had shrugged. The rattling, mechanical roar of the Chupacabra float. The European's blood, pale in the red light and black in the blue. The taste of the stone dust. The taste of Elena's mouth. Details that had been vague grew clearer until, by concentrating, he could hear the voices, feel the cloth of the shirt he'd worn, all of it. The thing from the mountain had taken him and had done something to him, imprisoned him in this vast, empty blackness through a process he could not imagine and for reasons he couldn't guess. The silence and the emptiness changed the nature of time. There was no longer a sense of duration. He couldn't say how long he had been there or whether he had slept. He could no more judge his own sanity than point north. Without context, ideas like madness and direction were meaningless. The movement, when it came, was so slight that Ramon could believe he had imagined it. Something nudged him. A current moved against his skin, an invisible current in an invisible sea. He had the feeling of being turned in slow circles. Something solid bumped his shoulder and then rose up against his back, or else he sank down upon it. The syrupy liquid streamed past him, flowing past his face and body. He thought of it as draining away, though he could as easily imagine being lifted up through it. The flow grew faster and more turbulent. A deep vibration shook him. Boom! Then again, beating through flesh and bone. Boom! Boom! A blurred, watery light appeared above him, very dim and immensely far away, like a star in a distant constellation. It grew brighter. The liquid in which he floated drained, the surface coming nearer like he was rising from the bottom of a lake, until he finally breached it, and the last of the liquid was gone. Air and light and sound hit him like a fist. His body convulsed like a live fish on a frying pan, every muscle knotting. He arched up like an epileptic, head and heels bearing his weight, his spine bent like a bow. something he couldn't see flipped him onto his belly, and he felt a needle slide in at the base of his spine. He vomited with wrenching violence, thick amber syrup gouting from his mouth and nose. And then again, sick, racking spasms that expelled even more, as if his lungs had been filled with the stuff. "I will live," Ramon told himself. "It's no worse than being sick from too much muscat. I can live through this." Another long needle dug into his neck. A cold fire sprang to life where the thing had pierced him. He felt the saliva-like secretion running down his sides, then heat, like boiling water, pouring into him. "What have you done to me?" Ramon tried to scream. "What did you put in me?" Suddenly, violently, his heart came to life, and with a terrible shudder, he began to breathe. The air he gulped cut like glass, and his heart thundered in his chest. The world went red. Pain drove away all thought, all sense of self, and then slowly abated. Another wave of the sickness shook him. He voided his bowels, weeping with pain and shame when he wasn't coughing. It seemed to go on for hours, but the moments of peace between spasms gradually grew longer, and it seemed as if some of the strength was beginning to come back to his arms and legs. His heart ceased to race like a bird trying to free itself from a net. Tentatively, he sat up. He was sprawled naked on the bottom of a metal tank not more than 10 feet square. So much for his measureless midnight ocean. The walls were too high to see over, and the lights, blue-white and bitter, were too bright to see past and make out the ceiling beyond. He tried to stand up, but his muscles were putty. It was bitingly cold. He settled against the metal floor and shivered, feeling his teeth start to chatter. He tried lifting an arm, but the impulse was slow to reach his flesh, and the limb swayed drunkenly when it rose. Strong smells that he couldn't identify burned his nostrils. A thing like a snake reared up above the rim of the tank, thick as a strong man's arm. It was a dead gray color, like old meat, and segmented like a worm's body. Pulsations seemed to travel along its length. Ramon saw it hesitate, as if considering him, and then stretch down toward him. 3 long, thin tendrils split off where the head should have been. The gray snake brushed aside Ramon's clumsy parry and seized him by the shoulder. Ramon struggled weakly, but his strength was gone, and the snake's grip was as cold and pitiless as death. Another snake stretched down and wrapped itself around his waist. The snakes lifted him smoothly out of the tank. He tried to scream, but the sound he made was more like a cough. He was high in the air now, above what seemed to be a vast, high-domed cavern, full of noise and lights and motion and alien shapes. The cavern swarmed with activity that Ramon could not resolve into recognizable patterns, having no reference for it. His nose and mouth were filled with a biting, acrid odor, something like formaldehyde. The 2 snakes set him down on a platform near one wall of the cavern, the surface solid but spongy, like a great dark tongue. He collapsed as soon as they released him, his legs too weak to bear his weight. He waited on his hands and knees, staring into the terrible bright lights, panting like a trapped animal, suddenly longing for the timeless darkness he'd left behind. It was dimmer here, in the angle of the wall and the cavern floor. Inchoate shapes moved ponderously in the shadows. As they came forward, they were finished and fleshed by the light. But Ramon still could not make them out. His mind kept fighting to resolve them into the familiar aspects of humanity, and terribly, terrifyingly, they would not. They were too big and shaped wrong, and their eyes were a bright, glowing orange. A needle slid out of the end of a hovering gray tentacle, thrust quickly into Ramon's arm, too quickly for him to move or protest. Another prickly wave of heat passed through him, and he suddenly felt much stronger. What kind of injection had it given him? Glucose? Vitamins? Perhaps there'd been a tranquilizer in it as well. His head was clear now, and he felt more alert, less frightened. He drew himself up to his knees, one hand instinctively covering his crotch. The shapes had stopped a few feet away. There were three of them, all bipedal, one bigger than the others. Ramon could see them more clearly now. His mind accepted them by treating them as frauds. He thought of them now as men wearing grotesque costumes, and kept looking for some unconvincing detail that would betray the disguise. Intellectually, he knew better, of course. They were not men in costume. They were not men at all. They were aliens, and not of any race he knew. Ramon had sailed among the stars on one of the great galley ships of the Silverenia, and once he had glimpsed three of the furred, six-legged Hizay on the back streets of Acapulco, exotic creatures that looked like a cross between a cat and a caterpillar. The Turu he had seen only on video, and even there they made his skin crawl. These aliens were not Turu, not Enya, not Sian, not members of any of the great races. They were not part of the universe as he knew it. They did not belong. 100 questions, accusations, and pleas fought in his mind. Who are you? What do you want? Please don't kill me. At least they were humanoid bipeds, not spiders or octopi or big-eyed blobs. Although something about the articulation of their limbs was disturbingly odd. The smaller two were perhaps 6.5 feet tall, the larger one 7 feet, which made even the shortest of them far taller than Ramon. Their torsos were columnar, seemingly of uniform breadth at hip and waist and shoulder, and surely they must weigh more than 300 pounds apiece. Although somehow the dominant impression they created was one of grace and suppleness. Their skins were glossy, shining, but each had its own distinctive coloration. One was a mottled blue and gold, the second a pale amber, while the largest one had yellowish flesh covered with strange swirling patterns in silver and black. All wore broad belts hung with unknown objects of metal and glass, and nondescript halters of some ash-gray and lusterless material. Their arms were disproportionately long, the hands huge, the fingers, 3 fingers, 2 thumbs, incongruously slender and delicate. Their heads were set low in a hollow between the shoulders and thrust a little forward on thick, stumpy necks, giving them a belligerent and aggressive look, like snapping turtles. Crests of hair or feathers slanted back from the tops of their heads at rakish angles. Quills protruded from their shoulders, the napes of their necks, and the tops of their spinal ridges, forming bristly ruffs. Their heads were roughly triangular, flattened on top, but bulging out at the base of the skull, the faces tapering sharply to a point. And the faces were faces out of a nightmare. Large, rubbery black snouts, streaked with blue and orange, trembling and sniffing, mouths like raw, wet wounds, too wide and lipless, and small, staring eyes set too low on either side of the snout. Orange eyes, hot and featureless as molten marbles, staring at him. They were staring at him as though he was a bug, and that fanned a spark of anger inside him. He got to his feet and glared back at them, still shaky but determined not to show it. Ramon Espejo knelt to nobody, especially not to ugly, unnatural monsters like these. "Which one?" he croaked, coughed, and began again. Which one of you pinche motherfuckers is paying for my van? The aliens didn't react to his words. The large one reached out a strangely articulated arm, a motion that reminded Ramon of seaweed stirred by some gentle oceanic current. Ramon frowned as the alien curled what he had to think of as its fingers back toward itself once, twice, three times. The thing paused and then repeated the movement. There was something studied about the motion, as though it had been learned by rote, as though its natural equivalent might be without meaning for humans. A low, thudding boom came from deep below them, a mountainous heart that beat twice and went silent. Ramon glanced around him. The alien repeated the curling gesture. "You want me to come close to you?" Ramon demanded. The great thing's snout twitched, and the quills on its head rose and fell. Again, the strange curling motion. Ramon suddenly recalled a journalist who had come to Sao Paulo from Kijiaki, whose only word of Spanish had been gracias. The alien was the same, a single gesture repeated for every occasion, employed ubiquitously. The alien turned away, took a few inhumanly graceful strides, then shifted its torso back toward Ramon and gestured again. "Follow me." The other two aliens were still as stone, except for the restless twitching of their snouts. "I get taken captive by aliens and they're too stupid to talk," Ramon said, bravado and anger filling him. "Hey, you, pendejo! Why the fuck would I follow you, eh? Give me a good fucking reason." The alien stood motionless. Ramon spat, the sputum vanishing as soon as it struck the black tongue-like platform, which seemed to absorb it with a slipping noise. Ramon shook his head in disgust. In fact, there didn't seem to be anything else for him to do but follow. He came forward slowly, his footing unreliable on the disturbingly wet, velvety ground, which gave under him with every step, looking warily all around him, wondering if he should try to run. Run to where, though? And some of the objects suspended from the alien's belt were almost certainly weapons. Ahead was a door cut through the naked rock of the cavern wall, into which the alien disappeared, looking back once again to make its favorite gesture. Trying to wear his nakedness like a suit of clothes, Ramon followed the alien into the darkness. The two other beasts fell in close behind. Chapter 6. Afterward, Ramon could not clearly remember that trip. He was led through tunnels barely wide and tall enough to allow the alien to pass. The tunnels slanted steeply up and down and doubled back on themselves, seemingly at random. The rock was slightly phosphorescent, providing just enough light to let him see his footing. He refused to look behind at the following shapes, although his nerves were crawling like worms. The silence was heavy here in the belly of the hill, although occasionally a faraway hooting could be heard through many thicknesses of rock. It sounded to Ramon like the noise damned souls might make, crying unheeded to a cold and distant god. Sometimes they passed through pockets of light and activity, rooms full of chattering noise and rich, rotten smells, rooms drenched in glaring red or blue or green illumination, rooms dark as ink, but for the faint silver line of the path they followed. Once they stood motionless for long moments in such a room, while Ramon's stomach dropped, and he wondered if they could be in an elevator. Each chamber they passed through seemed more surreal than the last. In one, things that looked like oversized spiders lay in a clump in the center of what looked like a sluggishly moving pool of glowing blue oil. Another high-ceilinged chamber teemed with aliens, swarming over terraced layers of strange objects on the cavern floor. Equipment, perhaps machines, computers, although most things here were so unfamiliar that they registered only as indecipherable blurs, weird amalgams of shape and shadow and winking light. Far across the cave, two giant aliens, similar to his three companions but 15 or 20 feet tall, labored in gloom, lifting and stacking what looked like huge sections of honeycomb, moving with ponderous grace, as unreal and hallucinatorily beautiful as stop-motion dinosaurs in old horror movies. To one side, a smaller alien was herding a flow of what looked like spongy molasses down a stair-step fall of boulders, touching the flowing mass occasionally with a long black rod, as if to urge it along. It was too much to take in. Ramon's conscious mind was spinning too fast in desperate attempts to make sense of what he saw. The nightmare walk became an interminable series of incomprehensibilities. A great gray tentacle reached out from one wall, caressing the alien before him, and then dropped to the ground and slithered away like a snake. A scent like cardamom and fried onions and rubbing alcohol filled the air and vanished. The deep, throbbing booms that he had heard earlier filled the air at intervals that seemed to have no pattern, though Ramon found himself slowly learning to anticipate them. Away from the chambers, in the tunnels, it was close and dark and silent. The lead alien's back gleamed pale and faint in the phosphorescent glow of the rock, like a fish in dark water, and for a moment it seemed to Ramon as if the markings on its flesh were moving, writhing and changing like living things. He stumbled and instinctively clutched the alien's arm to keep from falling. Its skin was warm and dry, like snakeskin. In the enclosed space of the tunnel, he could smell the alien. It had a heavy, musky odor, like olive oil, like cloves, strange rather than unpleasant. It neither looked behind, nor paused, nor made a sound. The three aliens continued to walk on imperturbably at the same steady pace, and Ramon had no choice but to follow after them or be left alone in the chilly darkness of this black alien maze. At last, they came to a stop in another garishly lit chamber. Ramon almost walked into the wide back of the alien in front of him. To the human eye, there was something subtly wrong about the proportions and dimensions of the chamber. It was more a rhombus than a rectangle. The floor was slightly tilted, the ceiling tilted at another angle, and not of uniform height. Everything subliminally disorienting, everything off, making Ramon feel sick and dizzy. The light was too bright and too blue, and the chamber was filled with a whispering susurrus that hovered right at the threshold of hearing. This place had not been made by human beings, nor was it meant for them. As he entered the chamber, he saw that the walls streamed with tiny crawling pictures, as though a film of oil was continuously flowing from ceiling to floor and carrying with it a thin scum of ever-changing images, swirls of vivid color, geometric shapes, mazy, impressionistic designs, vast, surrealistic landscapes. Occasionally, something recognizable would stream by. Representations of trees, mountains, stars, tiny alien faces that would seem to stare malignly at Ramon out of the fever dream chaos as they poured down to be swallowed by the floor. The alien who'd escorted him gestured him forward. Gingerly, Ramon crossed the chamber, feeling uneasy and disconcerted, unconsciously leaning to one side to correct the tilt of the floor and putting his feet down cautiously, as though he expected the chamber to pitch or yaw. In the center of the chamber was a deep circular pit lined by metal, and at the bottom of the pit was another alien. It was even taller than Ramon's guide's, and much fatter. The lower part of its body bloated to 4 or 5 times the circumference of the other aliens, and its crest and quills were much longer. Its skin was maggot-white and completely free of markings. White with age? dyed white as an indication of rank? Or was it of a different race? Impossible to say, but as the alien's eyes turned upward toward Ramon, he was seized and shaken by the force behind its gaze, by the harsh authority it exuded. He noticed, with another little shock, that the creature was physically connected to the pit. Things that might have been wires or rods or cables emerged from its body and disappeared into the smooth metal walls, forming an intricate cat's cradle around it. Some of the cables were black and dull, some were luminescent, and some, glossy red and gray and brown, pulsed slowly and rhythmically, as if with an obscene life of their own. The hot, orange eyes considered him. Ramon felt his nakedness acutely, but refused to bend to this alien's will, even to cover himself. The great, pale head shifted.
"Noun," the alien said. "Verb form, identifier, semantic placeholder, sense of identity."
Ramon stared at the alien, fighting to keep surprise from his face. It had spoken in Spanish. Ramon also spoke some English and Portuguese and French, as well as, of course, Portuglish, the bastard lingua franca of the colony. And quite clearly, though its voice was disturbingly rusty and metallic, as though it was a machine, how in hell had it learned a human language? "What the fuck are you saying?" Ramon said. "By holy Jesus, what do you want?"
"Idiomatic vulgarity, religious fear," the alien said,
and then, with something that sounded like disappointment,
"unflowing."
The great beast shifted in its web of wires and cables, its swollen abdomen rippling as if with a life of its own. Ramon felt his gorge rise. "What do you want from me?"
"You are man," the beast intoned.
"Yes, I'm a fucking man. What did you think I was?"
"You lack tatakroida. You are a flawed thing. Your nature is dangerous and tends to aubre."
Ramon spat on the ground. The arrogance of the harsh, unused voice and the steady gaze of those orange, unblinking eyes made him angry. In times of stress, when he had lost his first van in a drunken bet, when Liana had finally left him, when Elena threatened to throw him out, Ramon's rage had never deserted him. Now it returned, flushing him with heat and certainty.
"What are you, you creatures?" he said. "Where do you come from? From this planet? Somewhere else? What do you think you're doing, attacking me, keeping me here against my will? And what about my van, eh? Who's going to get me a new van?"
Suddenly, the absurdity of the situation struck him. Here he was, in an alien hive, locked away in the middle of a mountain, surrounded by demons, and he was bitching about his van. He had to fight down the urge to laugh, fearing that once he started, he would be unable to stop. The alien was staring at him wordlessly.
"If you want to talk, talk sense," Ramon rasped.
Anger gave him a sense of power and control that he knew was at odds with the truth. Any small thing that kept his mind his own, however, was precious. "You don't like what I am? You can show me the way out of this shithole." The great, pale alien seemed to take a moment to consider Ramon's words. Its snout lifted as if it was tasting the air.
"Those are sounds, not words," the alien said after a long pause. "Discordances outside proper flow. You must not speak in meaningless sounds, or you will be corrected."
Ramon shivered and looked away. His rage had ebbed as quickly as it had flared, and now he felt tired, chilled by the alien's imperturbability. "What do you want from me?" he asked wearily.
We do not want anything, the alien said. Again, you speak outside the way of reality. You have a function, therefore you exist. You will exercise that function because it is your purpose to do so. Your tatakroida. No wanting is involved. All is inevitable flow. You are man. You will flow in the pathways in which a man would flow. As he is of you, our path to him will be carved clean. You will fulfill your function.
The creature's voice seemed to be growing clearer as it spoke, as if every word brought it a greater understanding of Ramon's language. He wondered how long he'd have to talk to the thing before it took on a Mexican accent and started cussing.
And if I do not function as you wish? Ramon asked.
The alien paused, as though briefly puzzled.
You live, it said finally. Therefore you exercise your function. Non-functioning, you could not exist. To exist and yet not exist, you would be a contradiction, aubre, a disruption in the flow. Aubre cannot be tolerated. To restore balanced flow, it would be necessary to deny the illusion that you exist.
That was at least clear enough, Ramon thought, feeling goose flesh sweep across his skin. He chose his words carefully when he spoke again.
And what function am I to fulfill?
The hot orange eyes fixed on him.
Take care, the alien warned. That we must interpret your tatakroida for you is a sign that you incline toward aubre. But we will grant you a dispensation, as you are not a proper creature. Listen. A man has escaped from us. 3 days ago he fled from us, and we have not been able to find him. By this act, he has shown himself to be aubre, and so proved that he does not exist. The illusion of his existence must therefore be negated. The man must not be allowed to reach a human settlement, to tell other humans about us. Should he do so, that would interfere with our own tatakroida. Such interference is gesu. Prime contradiction. Therefore you will find him, negate him, in order to restore balanced flow.
How am I supposed to find him if you could not?
You are a man. You are the same. You will find him.
He could be anywhere by now, Ramon protested.
Where you would go and where he would go. They are the same. You will go where he has gone, and you will find him.
Ramon considered that.
So you mean there's a man out there who found you and got away, and now you want me to help you catch him before he can get back to civilization? You want me to hunt for you? Is that what you're saying?
The thing in the cables considered this.
Yes, it said.
And why the fuck would I do that?
The deep, awesome, booming sound rose from the depth of the planet below. Ramon was reminded again where he was and to what sort of creature he was speaking. Vertigo washed through him. The great alien didn't seem to notice his distress.
You are imbued with purpose,
it said, almost patiently.
Your heart beats. You exchange gases. You do so for a purpose. To be, and yet be without purpose, is contradictory. Your language is flawed, in that it can express illusory states. Your purpose is to aid in locating the man. If you are without purpose, the illusion of your existence must be rectified.
Well, Ramon thought, that was clear enough. Hunt or die. The answer was simple. He would lie. He had no intention of playing Judas goat for these demons. But likewise, he would never be able to break away from them, as long as he was ass deep in their mountain. If he could make his way to the open air, there was at least hope. A chilling thought struck him. "How long did you keep me here?" he asked. "Is it still summer out there? Because tracking some mad fucker in winter isn't going to work." The beast was silent. Ramon grew impatient. If the time he had spent in darkness had been long enough for the seasons to change, escape from the aliens would be suicide. The weather would kill him as effectively as a knife in the ribs. "How long was I in that fucking vat?"
3 days, the thing said without hesitation.
Ramon felt a stab of fear, sharper for being unexpected. "The man you want tracked down. That's how long he's been running. All the time I've been here." The alien paused for a long moment before its deep, hoarse voice answered.
"Yes."
This far to the north, there was no way it could be a coincidence. Ramon had been followed. Some poor fucker from the constabulary had come north after him, searching for the European's killer, and instead had walked into this scene from hell. Ramon couldn't help imagining it. A Diego Town cop, or maybe one of the governor's own security agents, making his stealthy way toward Ramon's camp, only to find scorched ground, twisted plastic, and these monsters flying from the great metal wall he had uncovered. Had the bastard had time to call for help? No satellites reached this far north, but the police had radio they could bounce off the atmosphere. Had the aliens destroyed the policeman's van as they had Ramon's? Ramon had been poor all his life, and like most poor people, the instinct to be afraid of the police had been burned into his soul. The thought that they had been close enough to him to fall into the same alien snare brought the coppery taste of panic to Ramon's mouth. And yet, his logical mind told him that the constabulary was his best hope now. Usually the last thing he'd want to see were the police, but there were situations dire enough, like this one, when even somebody like him, who had frequently run afoul of the law, would be damn glad to see the cops coming over the hill. If word could get as far as Fiddler's Jump, aid would come. The military forces of the colony. Ramon had to hope that the man who had been set to follow him was as good at fleeing as he had been at shadowing him. And if the cavalry came, and Ramon was freed, what then? He had killed the European. Would the governor still be hot to have Ramon hanged for it? Or would his part in discovering the alien nest win him amnesty? He was trapped between the devil and the deep blue sea. "All right," Ramon said. "You want the guy found? I'll find him for you. He's no friend of mine." He rubbed his chin shrewdly. It wouldn't do to give in too easily, though. Even things as strange as these might recognize that as subterfuge. "If I do this thing for you," he asked slyly, "what do I get out of it?" The alien stared at him for several long moments, long enough that Ramon began to fear that he had overplayed his hand.
"You are an improper and contradictory creature. Aubrey may manifest in you.
We will insure against such manifestations by accompanying you."
"You? All of you?"
"We?
Not we."
"Your language is flawed. It admits contradiction where none exists. We will separate part of the whole. Manek will sacrifice himself to maintain the flow. Manek is we, and not we. Manek will accompany you and watch over you. Through him, your Tata Kroida will be protected."
Well, the thought that the aliens would send him out alone into the bush, trusting him to keep to the task they had assigned, was one that had always been too good to be true. But the fact that there would be only a single guard was a blessing. Two or three of the things would have been difficult to evade. More than that, impossible. Only one, however. The alien who had led him here moved silently to Ramon's side. It was eerie. Nothing so big should be so quiet.
Manek, eh? Ramon said to the thing. Your name's Manek. I'm Ramon Espejo.
While Ramon was still wondering if he should attempt to shake hands with it, Manek abruptly reached out and took him by the shoulders, lifted him like a doll, and held him immobile in the air. Ramon fought instinctively, nights at the bar and in the street coming back to his arms and legs in a rage. He might as well have punched the ocean. Manek didn't budge. Up from the pit rose a pale, white snake. Ramon watched in horrified fascination. It was obviously a cable of some sort. Two bare wires protruded from the visible end. But its movements were so supple and lifelike that he could not help but think of it as a pale and sinister cobra. It reared almost to eye level, swayed slowly from side to side, and aimed its blind, pallid head at Ramon. The head quivered slightly, as though the snake was testing the air in search of its prey. Then it stretched out toward him. Again, Ramon tried desperately to break free, but Manek wrenched him effortlessly back into position. As the cable snake came closer, he saw that it was pulsating rhythmically, and that the two naked wires in its head were vibrating like a serpent's flickering tongue. His flesh crawled, and he felt his testicles retract. He felt his nakedness vividly now. He was unprotected, helpless, all of the soft, vulnerable parts of his body exposed to the hostile air.
"I'll do it!" Ramon shrieked. "I said I'd do it! You don't have to do this to me! I'll help you!"
The cable touched the hollow of his throat. Ramon felt a sensation like the touch of dead lips, a double pinprick of pain, a flash of intense cold. An odd, quivering shock ran up and down his body, as though someone were tracing his nervous system with feather fingers. His vision dimmed for a heartbeat, then came back. Manek lowered him to the ground. The cable was now embedded in his neck. Fighting nausea, he reached up and took hold of it, feeling it pulse in his hands. It was warm to the touch, like human flesh. He pulled at it tentatively, then tugged harder. He felt the flesh of his throat move when he tugged. To rip it free would obviously be as difficult as tearing off his own nose. The cable pulsed again, and Ramon realized that it was pulsing in time to the beating of his heart. As he watched, it seemed to darken slowly, as if it were filling with his blood. He saw with horror that the opposite end of the cable had somehow linked itself to the alien that had held him, blending into its right wrist. Manek. He was on a leash. A hunting dog for demons.
"The Sahel will not injure you, but it will help to resolve your contradictions," the thing in the pit said, as if sensing his distress but failing to understand it. "You should welcome it. It will help to protect you from Aubre. Should you manifest Aubre, you will be corrected. Like this."
Ramon found himself on the floor, though he did not remember falling. Only now that the pain had passed could he look back at it and realize that it had been the worst pain he had ever experienced, as a swimmer turns to look back at a wave that has passed over his head. He didn't remember screaming, but his throat was raw, and it almost seemed as if the echo of his shriek was still reverberating from the chamber walls. He caught his breath, and then retched. He knew that he would do whatever was required to prevent that from happening again, anything at all. And for the first time since he woke in darkness, Ramon Espejo felt truly ashamed.
"I will kill you all," Ramon thought. "Somehow I will cut this thing out of my throat, and then I will come and kill you all." school yourself, the pale alien said. Correct Aubrey, and even such a flawed thing as yourself may achieve cohesion or even coordinate level.
It took Ramon some time to realize that this gibberish had been a dismissal, a stern but kindly admonition. Hellfire threatened, the prospect of redemption dangled, and go forth and sin no more. The son of a bitch was a missionary. Manek lifted Ramon back to his feet and nudged him toward a tunnel. The fleshy leash, the Sahel, shrank to match whatever distance was between them. Manek made a sound that he couldn't interpret and apparently gave up gentle coaxing. The alien moved briskly forward, the Sahel tugging now at Ramon's throat. He had no choice but to follow, like a dog trotting at its master's heel.
And you, mi amigo, Ramon thought, staring at Manek's indifferent back, will be the very first to die.
Chapter 7 Back through the tunnels they went, through cavern after cavern, through rhythmic noise, billowing shadow, and glaring blue light. Ramon walked leadenly, like an automaton, pulled along by Manek, the tether in his neck feeling heavy and awkward. The chill air leached the heat from his body, and even the work of walking wasn't enough to keep him warm. As he stumbled along, in the privacy of his mind, Ramon searched for hope. How long would it be before Elena noticed his absence? Months, at least. Or she might think he'd gone off again, down to Nuevo Janeiro without her, to file his reports and collect his fees and keep his money for himself. Or run off on a drunken spree with some other woman. Rather than start a search for him, she was more likely to work herself into a blind rage and go fuck some hairy prospector from a bushmar or rum shack in revenge. Likewise, Manuel Griego would expect him to be in the field for 3 or 4 weeks at the least. Ramon silently berated himself for talking about hunting and his fantasy of disappearing into the Sierra Hueso to live off the land. Manuel might assume he wasn't coming back at all, especially if he suspected, as he probably did, that Ramon knew that the cops were after him. The only ones who would look for him were the law, and the law would have followed him with public execution in mind. There was no one. That was the truth. He had lived his life on his own terms, always on his own terms, and here was the price of it. He was on his own, hundreds of miles from the nearest human settlement, captured and enslaved. If he was going to get out of this, he would have to find his own way out. Manek tugged at the Sahel, and Ramon looked up, aware for the first time that they had stopped. The alien thing pushed a bundle into his arms. Clothes. The clothes were a sleeveless, one-piece garment, something like pajamas, a large cloak and hard-soled slipper boots, all made from a curious, lusterless material. He pulled them on with fingers stiff from cold. The aliens were obviously not used to tailoring for humans. The clothes were clumsily made and ill-fitting. But at least they afforded him some protection against the numbing cold. It wasn't until his nakedness was covered and warmth began to return to his limbs that his teeth began to chatter. Manek led him down a bright white passageway to another great, high-vaulted chamber. Things the color and size of aphids swarmed across the floor, bumping into each other and into his legs, singing incomprehensible gibberish in high, sweet voices. In the center of the room squatted a bone-colored box, like the one that had destroyed his van. As they drew near, Ramon saw that the thing was not solid. Instead, a million tiny strands of dripping white and cream made a webwork of slats that shifted to create an opening and then close it behind them. The interior of the box was likewise only half solid, a wide, low bench that appeared intended for Manek's barrel-like form, and also a smaller area set into the wall where Ramon himself might sit, legs pulled up to his chest. Ramon waited leadenly while Manek examined the box, leaning in to run its long, slender fingers carefully over the controls. He could feel himself becoming dazed and passive, numbed by weariness and shock. He'd been through too much, too fast, and he was tired, more tired than he could remember being before. Perhaps the shot they'd given him, glucose or adrenaline or whatever it had been, was wearing off. He was almost asleep on his feet when Manek seized him, lifted him into the air as if he was a little child, and stuffed him into the box. He struggled to sit up, but Manek seized his arms, drew them behind his back, and bound them with a thin length of wire-like substance, then hobbled his legs before turning and sitting down in front of the controls. Manek touched a push plate, and the box rose smoothly into the air. Acceleration shoved Ramon's head sideways, pinning it at an uncomfortable angle. In spite of the terror of his situation, he realized that he was unable to stay awake any longer. Even as they rose toward the high-domed cavern roof, his eyes were squeezing shut, as though the mild G-forces that pulled with mossy inevitability on his bones were also drawing him inexorably into sleep. Above them, the rock opened. As Ramon's consciousness faded, drowning him in hissing white snow, he saw, beyond the hole in the stone, a single pale and isolate star. A freezing wind lashed him awake. He struggled to sit up. The box lurched to the left, and he found himself looking through the spaces between the woven slats, straight down through an ocean of air at the tiny tops of the trees. The box canted over the other way violently, and the darkening evening sky swirled around his head, momentarily turning the faint, newly emerged stars into tight little squiggles of light. They leveled off. Manek sat behind the box's control panel, unshakably, firm and cold as a statue, quills rippling in the bitter wind. Banking again, they fell at a slant through the air. He couldn't have been insensible for more than a minute or two, Ramon realized. That was the alien's mountain just behind them, the exit hole now irised shut again, and that was the mountain slope where he'd been captured just below. Even as they coasted down toward the slope, the sky was growing significantly darker. The sun had sunk beneath the horizon some moments before, leaving only the thinnest sliver of glazed red along the junction line of land and air. The rest of the sky was the color of plum and eggplant and ash, dying rapidly to an inky blackness overhead and to the west. Armed and bristling with trees, the mountain slope rushed up to meet them. Too fast! Surely they would crash! They touched down lightly in the middle of an alpine valley, settling out of the sky as silently as a feather. Manek killed the box's engine. Darkness swallowed them, and they were surrounded by the sly and predatory noises of evening. Manek seized Ramon, and lifting him like a rag doll, dragged him from the box, carried him a few feet away, and dropped him to the ground. Ramon groaned involuntarily, startled and ashamed by the loudness of his voice. His arms were still bound behind him, and to lie upon them was excruciatingly painful. He rolled over onto his stomach. The ground under him was so cold that it was comfortable. And even in his sick and confused condition, Ramon realized that meant death. He thrashed and squirmed and managed to roll himself up in the long cloak he'd been given. It was surprisingly warm. He would have fallen asleep then, in spite of his pain and discomfort. But light beat against his eyelids where there had been no light, and he opened his eyes. The light seemed blinding at first, but it dimmed as his eyes adjusted. Manek had brought something from the box, a small globe attached to a long metal rod, and jammed the sharp end of the rod into the soil. Now the globe was alight, burning from within with a dim bluish light, emitting rhythmic waves of heat. As Ramon watched, Manek walked around the globe, the Sahel shortening visibly with each step, and came slowly toward him with seeming deliberation. Only then, watching Manek prowl toward him, seeing the wet gleam in the corner of its orange eyes as it looked from side to side, seeing the way its nose crinkled and twitched, the way its head swiveled and swayed restlessly on the stubby neck, the shrugging of its shoulders at each step, hearing the iron rasp of its breath, smelling its thick, musky odor. Only then did some last part of Ramon's mind fully accept the fact that he was its captive, alone and at its mercy in the wilderness. That simple knowledge hit Ramon with such force that he felt the blood begin to drain from his face, and even as he was worming and scrambling backward in a futile attempt to get away from his captor, he was losing his grip on the world, losing consciousness, slipping down into darkness. The alien stood over him, seen again through the hazy white snow of faintness, seeming to loom up endlessly into the sky like some horrid and impossible beanstalk with eyes like blazing orange suns. That was the last thing Ramon saw before the snow piled up over his face and buried him, and everything was gone. Morning was a blaze of pain. He had fallen asleep on his back, and he could no longer feel his arms. The rest of his body ached as though it had been beaten with clubs. The alien was standing over him again. Or perhaps it had never moved. Perhaps it had stood there all night, looming and remote, terrible, tireless and unsleeping. The first thing Ramon saw that morning, through a bloodshot haze of pain, was the alien's face. The long, twitching black snout with its blue and orange markings, the quills stirring in the wind and moving like the feelers of some huge insect. "I will kill you," Ramon thought once again. There was very little anger in it, only a deep, animal certainty. "Somehow, I will kill you." Manek hauled Ramon to his feet and set him loose, but his legs would not hold him, and he crashed back to the ground as soon as he was released. Again Manek pulled him up, and again Ramon fell. As Manek reached for him the third time, Ramon screamed, "Kill me! Why don't you just kill me?" He wormed backward, away from Manek's reaching hand. "You might as well just kill me now!" Manek stopped, its head tilted to one side to regard Ramon curiously, in an oddly bird-like manner. The hot orange eyes peered at him closely, unblinking. "I need food," Ramon went on in a more reasonable tone. "I need water. I need rest. I can't use my arms and legs if they're tied like this. I can't even stand, let alone walk." He heard his voice rising again, but couldn't stop it. "Listen, puto, I need to piss. I'm a man, not a machine." With a supreme effort, he heaved himself to his knees and knelt there in the dirt, swaying. "Is this Albre? Eh? Good. Kill me, then. I can't go on like this." Man and alien stared at each other for a silent moment. Ramon, exhausted by his outburst, breathed in rattling gasps. Manek studied him carefully, snout quivering. At last, it said,
"You possess Retihue?"
"How the shit would I know?" Ramon croaked, his voice rasping in his dry throat. "What the fuck is it?" He drew himself up as much as he could and glared back at the alien.
"You possess Retihue?" the alien repeated.
But it was not a question this time. It took a quick step forward, and Ramon flinched, afraid that the death he'd demanded was on its way. But instead, Manek cut him free. At first, he could feel nothing in his arms and legs. They were as dead as old wood. Then sensation flooded back into them, burning like ice, and they began to spasm convulsively. Ramon set his face stoically and said nothing. But Manek must have noticed and correctly interpreted the sudden pallor of his skin, for it reached down and began to massage Ramon's arms and legs. Ramon shrunk away from its touch. Again, he was reminded of snake skin, dry, firm, warm, but the alien's powerful fingers were surprisingly deft and gentle, loosening knotted muscles, and Ramon found that he didn't mind the contact as much as he would have thought that he would. It was making the pain go away, after all, which was what really counted.
"Your limbs have insufficient joints," Manek commented. "That position would not be uncomfortable for me."
It bent its arms backward and forward at impossible angles to demonstrate. With his eyes closed, Ramon could almost believe that he was listening to a human being. Manek's Spanish was much more fluent than that of the alien in the pit, and its voice had less of the rusty timbre of the machine. But then Ramon would open his eyes and see that terrible alien face, ugly and bestial, only inches from his own, and his stomach would turn over, and he would have to adjust all over again to the fact that he was chatting with a monster.
"Stand up now,"
Manek said. It helped Ramon up and supported him while he limped and stomped in a slow semicircle to work out cramps and restore circulation, looking as if he was performing some arthritic tribal dance. At last he was able to stand unsupported, although his legs wobbled and quivered with the strain.
"We have lost time this morning," Manek said. "This is all time we might have employed in exercising our functions."
Ramon could almost imagine that it sighed.
"I have not previously performed this type of function. I did not realize that you possessed retihue, and therefore failed to take all factors into account. Now we must suffer delays accordingly."
Suddenly, Ramon understood what retihue must be. He was more baffled than outraged. "How could you not realize that I was sentient? You were there all the while I talked to the white thing in the pit."
"We were present, but I had not integrated yet," Manek said simply.
It did not elaborate further, and Ramon had to be content with that.
"Now that I am, I will observe you closely. You are to demonstrate the limitations to the human flow. Once we are informed, the man's path is better predicted."
It gestured around them.
"Here is the last of places the man was known," it said.
Its voice was deep and resonant. Ramon could almost think that the thing sounded sorrowful.
"We will begin here."
Ramon looked around. Indeed, there were signs of a small, improvised camp. A tiny lean-to, hardly big enough to sleep in, had been constructed with fresh boughs and tied together with lengths of bark. A fire pit, ringed by stone, showed ashes where the lawman had cooked something at the end of a fire-hardened stick. Whoever they'd sent after Ramon had spent enough time in the field to know how to survive with what came to hand. Good for him. Manek stood silent by the bone-colored box, the thick, fleshy sahel attached to its arm. Ramon looked at it, waiting to see what strategy the thing would adopt. The alien, however, did nothing. After a few minutes of uncomfortable silence, Ramon cleared his throat. "Monster? Hey, now we're here. What is it you want me to do, eh?"
"You are a man," Manek said. "Behave as he would behave."
"He's got tools and clothes, and he doesn't have a leash on," Ramon said.
"Your confluence will be approximate at the beginning," Manek said. "This is expected. You will not be punished for it. Your needs will lead you to a matched flow. That is sufficient."
"Speaking of needs and flowing," Ramon said, "I gotta piss."
"That will do," Manek said. "Begin by achieving piss."
Ramon smiled. "You stay here then. I'll go achieve piss."
"I will observe," Manek said.
"You want to watch me piss?"
"We are to explore the banks which bound the man's possible channels. If this task is a necessity of his being, then I will understand it."
Ramon shrugged. "You're just lucky I'm not shy about this kind of thing," he said, walking to the nearest tree.
There's some men couldn't get a drop out, not with you watching them, eh?"
The ground was rough, and Ramon's feet were tender. The long bath in the alien gel seemed to have softened away all his calluses. As he relieved himself against the tree trunk, he tried to make sense of the alien's behavior. "The limitations of human flow," it had said. For a being so impatiently concentrated on pragmatic results, Manek was strangely interested in Ramon's need to urinate, which ought to have struck it as irrelevant. It wasn't an activity that seemed important to hunting the fugitive, but it had not known that binding his arms behind him would discomfort him either. Perhaps the aliens needed him to understand what the habits of a man were. He was more than a hound. Merely by being human, he was a guide for them. Ramon stood for a long moment after his bladder was empty, taking the opportunity to turn his mind to strategy. He could not refuse the aliens. The demonstration of the pain his leash could deliver had convinced him of that. But there was a long history of labor protests in which things simply took a longer time and more materials than expected. Slowdowns. Ramon might have to be on the job for these devils, but he didn't have to be a good worker. He would move slowly, explain the fine points of pissing and shitting and hunting and trapping for as long as Manek would allow it. Every hour Ramon could waste was another one that the lawman had to make his return to civilization and send help back. How things would unfold once that had happened, Ramon didn't know. He shook his penis twice as long as was truly required, then let the robe drop back down to cover his knees. Manek's great head shifted, but whether this was a sign of approval or disgust, Ramon had no way to tell.
"You are complete?"
Manek asked.
"Sure," Ramon said. "Complete enough for the moment."
"You have other needs?"
"I'll need to find fresh water to drink," Ramon said, "and some food to eat."
"Complex chemical compounds which can be harvested of their potential to facilitate flow and prevent pooling," Manek said. "This is Mehiban. How will you manufacture this?"
"Manufacture? I'm not going to make it. I'm going to catch it. Hunt for it. What is it you devils do?"
"We consume complex chemical compounds. These are Iuthaloi. Made things.
But the Ike I have would not nourish you. How do you obtain food? I will allow you to procure it for yourself."
Ramon scratched his arm and shrugged.
"Well, I'm going to kill something. I'd try making a sling, maybe, killing a flatfur or dragon jay, but I've got this fucking thing in my neck. You wouldn't want to take it out of me, just long enough I can show you how this is done?"
Manek stood unresponsive as a tree.
"Didn't think so, monster. It's trapping, then. It might take a little longer, but it will do. Come on."
In fact, the fastest and easiest thing would have been to gather up sug beetles, as he had the other night. He had seen a few even this deep under the forest canopy. Or a half hour of gathering would have gotten him enough Mayan berry to make a small meal. This far north you could pick them off the trees by the handful. Feeding off the land wasn't hard. The amino acids that had built up the biosphere of Sao Paulo were almost all identical to those on Earth. But that would have been simple, and would have allowed them to move quickly on to whatever the next phase of their hunt would be. So instead, Ramon taught the alien how to